everybody. This is Armand Demel with you with the Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Giving you ideas, concepts, quests to help you lead a more positively minded life. It's such a wonderful life out there. You know, it's such a beautiful thing. One of the beauties of living in New York, as someone was telling me earlier today, was she had the opportunity to go down to Brighton. And she said she went to Brighton, and there she walked into a store where they only spoke Russian. Nobody spoke any English. And she said she went uptown, somewhere uptown, and she went to a store where she met people who spoke Spanish and spoke no English at all, but they had a store. They were actually selling things. And part of the beauty is learning, and learning so much. And I've always find learning as one of the excitement joys of being alive. Sometimes I'm really glad I'm not a flower. You know, a flower has a, it's like it's nice, it's pretty, it goes a certain distance, and then after a while it just, you know, flops over, dies, and becomes a seed for something else. I like the idea of transformation. I like the idea of being able to move myself along, to become a little more than maybe my ancestors might have known as their potential. Do you think you're living beyond your ancestral potential? You should be, because, you know, with all this stuff available out here and all this new education and learning, we're living longer than we ever lived before. We have more insight into our relationships with each other. You, especially those of you that listen to the Positive Mind, you know, you're conscious people. You're people who care about people. So it's a beautiful thing to be part of this learning mechanism. And, of course, as we know, through the Internet, this learning is now going all over the world. And people are listening and saying, wow, there's more I could do. Well, part of this more I could do is learning about neuroplasticity. Learning about what we started talking about on Tuesday with Dr. Norman Doidge, D-O-I-D-G-E, who wrote a book called The Brain That Changes Itself. We had an exciting interview on Tuesday talking about neuroplasticity. As a fast review for you, because today we're going to investigate a few different things. We're going to look at the inevitability of Alzheimer's, whether or not it is. We're going to look at romantic love from a neuroplasticity point of view. And we're going to look at a couple of other things, creativity, so on and so forth. Let's pain, and I'm very interested in pain and how you could change pain. So let's start with Norman. Norman, welcome back. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Sure. Couldn't we? We were chomping at the bits. Our audience was writing in saying, please get him back and let's continue this. So you are in demand. Let's just, for those who may not have tuned in on Tuesday, talk about neuroplasticity, if we can briefly talk about it. What
sure.
It is.
Neuroplasticity is a property of the brain that has been recently discovered, and it allows our brains to change their structure and their function depending on what we do. Now, it's a revolutionary discovery because for 400 years, since the dawn of modern science, our best and brightest neuroscientists believed that the brain couldn't change its structure. Rather, they believed that any circuits in the brain were formed and fixed and finalized either in the womb or in early childhood more recently. And the brain was conceived of as this glorious machine. And, of course, many of your listeners have probably used that computer metaphor for the brain and spoke of this ability or that one as being hardwired. Now, when we do so, we are using this machine metaphor. When we speak of depression as nothing but a chemical imbalance in the brain or a lack of a certain chemical in the brain, we're using a modified machine metaphor, basically where receptors get signaled by chemicals and those chemicals are missing. Now, I'm not saying that there's nothing to this, but it's a metaphor, and it turns out to be as concealing of what the brain is like as it is revealing. Now, when scientists very recently began in a mainstream way to question this metaphor, it's been replaced by this idea of neuroplasticity. So Now, here's how fantastic this idea is. At the dawn of modern science, Descartes, who was the greatest neuroscientist of his time but was also very theoretical, said that human beings were divided into two substances. One of them was a material substance, and that was the brain, and it was governed by the material laws, the mechanical laws of physics, and it was like a complex machine. But he knew what we thought, and so he said we were made of a second substance, which was the irrational soul. It didn't exist in space and time the way our brains do. And he said, yes, we can change our minds. That soul is very dynamic, but the brain is like a machine. Unfortunately, he created this abyss between the soul and the brain. And we never knew how to bridge it. He could never credibly prove that we were made of two substances. And he could never explain how our thoughts can send a signal and tell, you know, so that I decide I'm going to lift my arm and I lift my physical arm. Now, what we're going to get into today is the crumbling of that metaphor and the breaking down to a certain degree of that mind-body distinction that Descartes did. We now know, actually largely through some work that was done by Eric Kandel and his colleagues at Columbia University in New York, that when we learn something, and that includes when we think something new, our minds, if you will, stimulate our nerve cells in the most profound way. They actually turn on certain genes in the nucleus of the nerve cells in the brain to manufacture proteins, which then travel down the cell and radically transform its structure so that if there is a cell connected to a second cell with 1,300 connections, in a matter of hours, those 1,300 branches can be transformed into 2,700. This is not what we would call a hardwired model. This is a model that's an open model where thought has a major, major implications on this influences on the system. And this, of course, means that something like psychotherapy or talking with someone in a very important conversation is as much as a biological intervention as taking a drug, only that it's much more precise, because when you take a drug, it's a very blunt instrument. Again, I'm not simply against drugs in any simple-minded way, but it's important to keep in mind drugs bathe your entire brain and your entire body, and if you can change something through thoughts, you're going into a particular network. So neuroplasticity, it turns out, also allows our brains to improve their functioning. And when one of the great neuroplasticians, that's a term I have for these people at this cutting edge, Michael Merzenich, began to study what happens when you train your neurons, he learned that when you do so, the neurons fire faster, they fire stronger, clearer signals. And out of that work, he developed brain exercises for older people and for children and adults with learning disorders.
Good. Well, that brings us right to what I was going to say for the end, but let's go right there. Alzheimer's, a creeping disorder. More and more people, Newsweek, for those people who haven't seen it. If you have somebody in your family, and you probably do, who's got Alzheimer's, take a look at Newsweek from last week, which had an issue which specialized in the caregivers for Alzheimer's, because it's the inability of the caregivers to understand and deal with the Alzheimer patient that has had the greatest consequences. The Alzheimer patient's not doing as badly as the caregivers are doing. And Newsweek was dedicated to that. So understanding Alzheimer's, what it is, but not seeing it as inevitable, seeing it as a potential thing, seeing it as something that could be reversed, is what I would like to talk to you about, Norman.
Okay.
How do you see that? I mean, do you see?
Okay, this is a complex issue. In the first, let me set the stage for the issue as to, you know, why it's important from a statistical point of view. It's estimated that by the time that someone who is 65 right now dies, the human life expectancy will be in the late 80s. Now, when you're, let's say, 85, in fact, there's a 47% chance that you will have Alzheimer's disease. That's very, very scary. As Merzenich says, we've created this very bizarre situation, which we're keeping people alive long enough so that they can get Alzheimer's before they die. And the goal of his work and other people's work is to see if there isn't something we can do about the mental lifespan to extend it out into the body's lifespan, if you will. You
know, yes, in effect, you're saying the body is being helped to survive the 85 years, but the brain is not. It hasn't. They haven't found a way to get the brain to go.
Yeah, you know, we've created a situation which is very, in a way, reminiscent. This is why one has to be very, very careful with medicine and what you do.
You can't mess with Mother Nature, man.
You know, there's this ancient Greek myth about Tithonus, and he prayed for immortality. And so the gods, in a kind of peevish way, granted him immortality, but they didn't grant him immortal youth. So he got to spend most of eternity in a very aged, decrepit condition. Now, we've inadvertently created this problem. Now, is there something we can do to extend the mental lifespan? And let me distinguish between two different conditions and then try to set the stage for describe the conventional approach and then the neuroplastic approach. Okay, the first condition is a more benign condition called age-related cognitive decline. And it's something most human beings in our culture, or many, many human beings in our culture, start to get in their 50s when they have senior moments. And they get very frightened that it could mean they have Alzheimer's, but they think they're slowing down and they're less alert. And that condition, which is an important condition, you know, your alertness decreases, your ability to balance when you're walking decreases, so there's more slips and falls. You know, there are more seniors are more concerned about falling than they are about being mugged, even in a place like New York City, okay? So balance system starts to go awry. It's one that we take for granted most of our lives, but it's absolutely crucial. The ability to drive leads to having to stay at home, et cetera. And the ability to socialize is largely dependent on our ability to speak and think with language. So it turns out that this is, without a doubt, a reversible condition. The reason it comes about is because by the time we get to middle age, we are relying on just replaying already mastered skills in our lives. You know, if we're in a relationship, be it good or bad, we sort of know the rules of it. If we've got a job, we've probably been in it for, you know, decades now. We're not doing the kind of brain workout that's necessary to maintain your brain. To maintain your brain, you can't just do the usual things. You can't dance the old dances. You can't just read the same paper. You've got to actually do certain kinds of workouts. And, okay, a lot of people are doing some of these things with crossword puzzles, etc., and that's good. But Merzenich's also developed a second method, which is that you rebuild the language part of the brain, the auditory cortex, from scratch, the way you learned to build it up as a child when you learned to distinguish very simple sounds, ba and da and ta. And he goes in from the very beginning with computer programs. They're now marketed by a company called Posit Science, P-O-S-I-T, new word science, which is on the Internet. And you can plug them into a computer, and within 6 weeks, you can transform your brain and turn back the clock between 10 to 25 years with 6 weeks an hour a day, which is quite remarkable. And this has been studied in controlled studies.
You've personally studied this? I mean, you've looked at this yourself?
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, I didn't do those controlled studies, but those controlled studies were done by esteemed universities, and I spoke to one man, for instance, Stanley Karansky, 90-year-old man who was actually a medic at D-Day, who was a doctor for many years, an anesthesiologist, and then he retired, as I recall, when he was 70, and then a very active person with a fantastic attitude. He got bored and retrained as a family doctor. But when he got to be 89, he noticed he was slowing down. He was having senior moments. He was beginning to retreat socially, his wife noticed. His handwriting got worse. His alertness deteriorated. He said, I like to drive fast, but he was having more difficulty. He did the program, and in 6 weeks, all of those things reversed. But this has also been studied.
Now, wait, Norman. This is very important because, you know, one of the most exploited of all groups of people happen to be now this new, the Alzheimer's groups and people with that, the aging group. And here's a man who's a remarkable man his whole life. So it makes sense that somewhere as he gets older, he's going to be a remarkable man and be able to do a remarkable reversal. Do we know of people who are average
folks? Oh, yeah, sure. Okay. I mean, these studies that were done of the Posit Science program, you know, he's just one remarkable man. I'm telling the tale because he's such a great exemplar as to how we should be living our lives. You know, he exercises, by the way. He does weight machines and he does cardiovascular. That's why I describe him in detail in the book. But this has been applied to everybody. This has been applied to average populations. One of the things I want to emphasize that the studies all show, without any doubt whatsoever, is that our brain plasticity exists from cradle to grave. Yes, in our very early years when we're learning language, etc., there are spurts of plasticity that are considerable. But we now know that it exists from cradle to grave. And part of the problem has been is that we have just assumed that the mind necessarily tends to fall apart. Now, maybe I could just bridge into that. You know, what Stanley Kuransky had was age-related cognitive decline. And now the question becomes, okay, what about if a person has Alzheimer's? Okay, before we thought of the brain as being plastic, you know, this has been what the basic approach has been to Alzheimer's, the commonest approach. And it's this. You know, there are just literally thousands of scientific papers that are written about the physical and chemical changes that are occurring in the aging brain and the processes that are at work as our neurons decline. And there are scores of drugs in the pipeline now, and many of them are already available. And what they basically all do is they try to raise the levels of the falling chemicals in the brain. And, this is a multi-million, actually billion-dollar industry. And what these drugs generally tend to do is they tend to give about 4 to 6 months of improvement. Now, one of the potential weaknesses in this approach is the following. Do you know how I said that once we hit middle age, we generally replay mastered skills?
Yes.
The part of the brain that modulates brain plasticity, that regulates it, is a part that requires intense mental exercise. And most of us have stopped doing that. We don't pay the attention we paid when we were studying a French vocabulary in high school or university, and we can go for decades without doing that. And that area starts to waste away in the brain just through neglect or atrophy, okay? And so, you know, we behave as though we don't have to maintain our brains. Now, as we get older, we're more aware that we should be exercising, you know, walking vigorously, etc., as we get older. But we don't, you know, think that it's absolutely necessary or essential to mental health. So the question becomes, this atrophy, is that contributing in some way or other to things like Alzheimer's? And, okay, so where are we with that?
Well, there must be some interesting research on who gets it and who doesn't.
There's a lot of research on that. In this area. So here your listeners have to listen very carefully because there's some subtle distinctions. We know for a fact that there are correlations between being more mentally active and having less of a chance of getting Alzheimer's. Now, that's a correlation. Those people who are less mentally active tend to get more Alzheimer's. What we don't know for sure yet is whether that lack of mental activity is causing the Alzheimer's, as some suspect, or whether it's actually evidence that there already is some Alzheimer's that's taken hold, causing the person to be less mentally active. But there have been large-scale studies that show that people who do certain kinds of activities, including things like learning new dances and cognitive activities and social activities, have less Alzheimer's. Now, that is going to be sort of that question, whether these correlations cause low Alzheimer's or are an effect of Alzheimer's. Whether low mental activity causes Alzheimer's or it's an effect of Alzheimer's is being worked on by scientists right now.
I saw a correlation between retirement and Alzheimer's. Believe it or not, those higher incident among people who retire and people who don't retire. And that's kind of simple right there.
Yeah, but that could be the same thing. It could be that people who feel their brains are pooping out retire.
I suspect, frankly, that
how you use your brain will turn out to be a factor. But this hasn't been definitively proven. There's also another thing that people should note, and that is it has fairly recently been discovered that physical exercise gives rise to new neurons, to new nerve cells in the brain. And what kind of physical exercise? The physical exercise involved in vigorous long walks is sufficient to do it. And let me tell you a little bit about how this was discovered. You know, another one of the great new discoveries is that we do actually grow new nerve cells in a part of our brains called the hippocampus. It's a small, smallish seahorse-shaped part of the brain, which is absolutely crucial to learning. It turns our short-term memories into long-term memories. It also has to do with orienting us in space. But if you can't turn short-term memories into long-term memories, then you are in trouble because you're sort of trapped in the eternal present. And Frederick Gage is an American, along with a man named Erickson from the Scandinavian country, recently, just within the last decade, discovered that we make new neurons in this part of the brain until the day we die. 100 years ago, the finest neuroanatomist alive, the Nobel Prize winner Ramon y Cajal, spent the later part of his career trying to see if there was any sign of growth in the aging brain and simply couldn't find it. But they found an ingenious way to label or take pictures of cells as they were dividing. And yes, there are little stem cells in the brain that divide, and the same lab, Frederick Gage and Henriette von Prague, working with a number of other colleagues in San Diego at the Salk Institute, have found that if you do physical exercise, you get a spurt of these new cells. Gage has a fascinating theory about that ties into learning. He calls it anticipatory proliferation. He thinks that the reason that this evolved is that when an animal, when there's a change of season or an animal has to change its habitat or environment, it's going to have to go on long walks. And if it's going to have to go to a new environment, there's going to be a massive amount of learning that's going to have to be done. And so Gage theorizes that that's why there's this proliferation. But those of us who live in cities and don't get our exercise are deprived of this potential for rejuvenation of our brains. The other way to keep the brain rejuvenated is through cognitive exercise, because when you do that, you actually keep cells in the brain from dying.
And what would be some good cognitive exercises besides things like listening to WBAI, which is an all-talk radio station where you hear new information all the time, and shows like this with Norman Doidge, by the way. Dr. Norman Doidge, psychiatrist. The Brain Changes Itself is the name of the book. We're talking about neuroplasticity, which is about the flexibility of the brain, the ability of the brain to grow new cells and learn new things. Alzheimer's, you're not doomed. It's not inevitable. You can keep changing. So we've talked about so far one of the things, physical exercise, especially walking or treadmill, I imagine. And second to that, now we're talking about brain exercises. Norman, we only have about 5 minutes before we have to take a break. Give me some specific brain exercises we could do besides listening to
you. I'll give you principles, okay? The principle is, and this is not hard to take, you should do something that you really enjoy. And that's not just a feel-good phrase from me. It has to do with your brain chemistry. When you're doing something that's really exciting to you and you enjoy, But that's also new. You secrete a brain chemical called dopamine, which helps consolidate the change and strengthen that one of those regulatory mechanisms for plasticity. So if there's something you always wanted to do, that's really important to do. And there are many interesting stories of people doing this. The late first prime minister of the state of Israel was a political man, obviously, David Ben-Gurion, and he always wanted to learn ancient Greek because democracy came from the ancient Greeks. And so when he was very, very well along, he started to learn Greek. And that would be like the ideal kind of thing because it taxes you, and yet it's the kind of thing you've put aside and always wanted to do.
So travel might be a good idea.
Travel, just like those little animals.
Just like the little animals.
And learning little bits of new language.
I like even, you know, with something like New York or Europe and Canada, there is so much that you could learn just here in New York, just traveling around the different parts of New York instead of staying in one place.
Yeah.
We have a subway system that will take you like 10 miles from end to end, and you wind up going from neighborhood to neighborhood in amazing, amazing discoveries. And along the way, your subway is filled with people who are brand new, who are all new. Everyone is a teacher. Every human who walks in has something to tell you about the way they choose to dress.
You've got to have that passionate, curious attitude. And then the thing you're learning has to be challenging to you. It can't be a cinch. It really can't simply be a replay of something you've done before.
Sameness is dangerous.
The most dangerous thing for you in this sense is to keep doing what you're doing.
I remember once being down in Florida around one of the retirement apartment houses, and they had signs, "No children running around the pool." And everything was to restrict anything that would shake up the comfort of the person who was laying by the side of the pool in the very programmed way that they wanted to lay on the side of the pool and then have their bingo night. And it was so programmed that this is the place to come to die, because nothing new happened there, and newness was not allowed. Excitement was not allowed.
Yeah, and if you think about it, the way we've, for instance, traditionally treated people, who've had strokes, it's a use it or lose it brain is something that the neuroplasticians have shown over and over again. That experiment's been done thousands of times. If you take a person who's had a stroke and has some decreased use of an arm, and you tell them, well, don't try to use that arm, and then you put them in a smaller and smaller environment where there's less and less novelty, yes, you are not giving the brain enough stimulation to stay fit. If you just give it the same low level of stimulation, it will start to waste away. There were many experiments where people were driven quite temporarily crazy that were done in the 50s and 60s that were, in sensory deprivation experiments. They put people in these water tanks with no stimulation, or some people in solitary confinement, the same kind of thing. And what happens is that people start to hallucinate and have difficulties. The brain requires input. It evolved in a changing world to change itself and to stay fit by changing.
Norman, stay with us. It's also why it really pays to choose a mate or select a mate who is equally curious, who can go with you, who takes the trips with you. And if you have a mate who isn't willing to do it or can't, find a friend. And if your mate objects to it and says, oh, I'm afraid I'm losing you, work it out somehow, because you can't let yourself just stay there and stay in one place. We're going to have to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll play you something different for you than you've heard before. And when we come back, we'll be back with Dr. Norman Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself, about neuroplasticity. Back in a couple of minutes, my friends. Yothu Yundi. Yep, Y-O-T-H-U, Yothu Yundi. So Nico from Shibumi was confined to prison for how many years was that? 3 years. And what he did was he learned the Basque language. Keep his mind active, you know? Fantastic stuff. You know, in New York City, my friends, this is New York City, and it's a remarkable place, New York City. I've been all over the city over these last few weeks. I was up in Harlem on Sunday going to a Episcopal a prayer meeting because it was exciting. I went down on Saturday to Theater 80 and walked in, and I saw some of the best flamenco I ever saw in my life. You might check that out. And then our own, you know, one of the daughters of WBAI, Alexandra Beller, who was on our radio program when she was 17 years old, which was like 18 years ago, is doing a performance at a place called the Here Arts Center. Here Arts Center. And I saw this performance. I saw a preview of it yesterday. Remarkable creativity. So way beyond dance. She was a center fold issue in the New York Times Magazine section. I guess you say centerfold, you have to go beyond that, huh? The New York Times Magazine section. And she was one of our, she's one of our people here. So she's doing this performance at the HERE, H-E-R-E, Arts Center. But phenomenal, phenomenal statement, phenomenal. And so you learn, you know, they go to Central Park on a Sunday. People come to me, they come visit New York, and they say, where should I go? Go to Central Park on a Sunday and walk around, and you see every culture doing every kind of dance and skating and everything you could imagine. Just such an exciting world. We're talking with Dr. Norman Deutsch, who's really helping this world create a more exciting life, because it's right. We've learned to bring our bodies to a life expectancy of 85, but our minds have a life expectancy of somewhere around 65. So the mind is supposed to suddenly go, and according to Norman Deutsch, no, absolutely not. You do exercise for the body, do the exercise for the body, which is very good, but do exercise for the mind. And the exercise for the body that he recommends the most, or others recommend, is walking. Walking because it's not just treadmill walking. It's walking so that you see newness, so that you see things happening around you, and you're learning as you walk, which oxygenates the body as well as gives you new information. He also says to exercise the mind, do something that is a challenge to you, but you enjoy. If it's learning a new language, or if it's learning a new dance, because that does involve the intellect, do it. Go see music you've never seen, you know. Now, I wanted to take this, Norman, and if you don't mind, because we have such limited time, I want to talk about pain. There are people who live with chronic pain. What could be done about pain and the pain that people live with? What have we learned from neuroplasticity about dealing with pain?
Okay, well, there are two kinds of pain, basically, that we have. The first kind is acute pain. And so you just put some coffee to your lips. It's very, very hot. It scalds your tongue. And you sort of take it away very quickly because that is a signal that this thing is dangerous for you. And so then the pain signal shuts off, but it's protected your innards, if you will, from swallowing that hot thing. So it's a very welcome thing. And people who are, I just want to sort of lay the groundwork for this. People who are born with a condition where they cannot feel pain, and there are some children who have that, often don't make it past their 20s. They actually die because they'll do things like they'll hurt their foot and they'll develop infections that they're not aware of and get septic, and it's a terrible condition to live a life, ironically as it may sound, without a pain system. Now, sometimes it happens that when we are hurt, we damage not only the limb, but the pain system itself, and then we can develop a kind of chronic pain, a pain that doesn't go away, that doesn't go away long after the pain system itself has healed itself. And this problem very frequently ties into plastic changes in the brain. So, you know, we've been talking about the upside of plasticity so far.
Give me an example of that. Let's talk about arthritic pain.
Well, I'd rather talk about, if you don't mind, the most graphic example of that, which is the case of a painful phantom limb,
the amputee.
Yeah, so now there are many phantom limbs have been around for a long time. During the Civil War, physicians started to notice it because the people would be amputating wounded limbs because of the nature of battle very frequently, and the soldiers would be left with a sense that the limb was there and was excruciating to them. So this was a great demonstration that our pain, that we don't even need a limb on our bodies to feel pain. It was a great demonstration that there's obviously some system in the human brain that's deals with pain. It was a mystery for many years. But this isn't such a rare mystery. It doesn't just happen to soldiers, for instance. There are many, many examples of people with haunting pains that torment them that are akin to this.
There aren't many of us walking around with phantom limbs, but do you suspect that migraine pain might be dealt with using neuroplastic knowledge and applications?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not even 100% some of the thinking about migraine, as I understand it, is lately evolving. But let me give an example of some very common pains. It's not uncommon that after routine surgery, people are left with very mysterious post-operative pains, some of which last a lifetime. And there are even these bizarre stories of women who suffered menstrual cramps and labor pains even after their uteruses had been removed in hospital, or people who had ulcers, and the ulcer and even parts of the stomach were removed, and they were still left with pain. This is not as rare as it sounds. And these are generally called neuropathic pain syndromes because they involve the nervous system. And they lead our pain maps to give incessant false alarms. And I'll give more examples of it, but it's much more common than most people think.
Well, more common of a neuropathic pain syndrome would be something like sciatica.
Well, there may be a chronic irritation. There probably is a chronic irritation occurring in sciatica, as I understand it. But sometimes there are secondary levels. You see, what happens is when a pain system is stimulated very frequently, because it's plastic, like the rest of the brain, like all neurotissue, sometimes you set up circuits that start to grow and just keep firing and firing and firing. And so many ordinary pains that last longer than they should actually are lasting because there have been plastic changes in the brain that have perpetuated.
So you might experience something as excruciating once, and then anything that might trigger the memory of that excruciating pain might trigger an excruciating pain memory, so you would have a bigger pain reaction because...
In my book I describe a very tragic condition called reflex sympathetic dystrophy, RSD, where a person might get something like an insect bite, and in a case of plasticity going completely, so it's painful, or have some kind of injury on a limb, and then basically what happens is the pain system goes into these endless false alarms and it gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And soon if you touch any part of the limb, not just the part where they had the insect bite, they feel literally excruciating pain. And it can keep them up at night. And, these people used to go to doctors. They still do in many cases. And the doctors would say, you're crazy. Or they probably wouldn't say you're crazy. They'd think you're crazy, or they'd say you should see a psychiatrist or whatever, because they were trapped in the old theory of how pain works, which is that pain is basically in the limb itself, not in the brain, and that it always files an accurate damage report.
Well, that's, I think, the important one, the knowledge that the brain does not always fire an accurate damage report.
That's right.
And that's very important because therefore, sometimes you have to actually ask yourself, is this my historical reaction? Is this my current reaction? How would you change it if you thought for a minute that your brain is just doing an inaccurate damage report?
Okay, well, this is not a simple matter. I can tell you one very dramatic case, which I think is one of the turning points and will be seen years from now as one of the great cases in, you know, modern neurology, which is about a man who had pain in his phantom limb and who couldn't move it. But there was a man who basically lost his arm who came to a very brilliant neurologist, V.S. Ramachandran. And basically, this happened in sort of several stages. The first one was a man came and he had an itch he couldn't scratch. And because it's a use-it-or-lose-it brain, Ramachandran was trying to figure out what was happening inside the brain maps after this limb was lost. And he knew that the brain map for the hand and the arm are very close to the brain map for the face. And so when he saw this man who had this chronic itch in this non-existent arm he couldn't scratch, he decided to scratch other parts of the man's body, and he finally scratched his cheek, and the pain, the unscratchable itch went away.
Far out.
And what had happened in the brain was there was no longer input coming to the part of the brain that was mapping for the hand. So the adjacent facial map invaded that part of the hand map and started using it. It's a use-it-or-lose-it brain, and if there's a piece of cortical or brain real estate that's not being used, the adjacent areas will invade it. But sometimes when they invade it, there are little sort of wiring problems, so that, for instance, If you took the facial map and there were some thin nerves that had to do with feeling, and they cross-wired with pain nerves, every time you touched the man's face, he would feel pain in his arm, even if the arm wasn't even part of his body. Now, these little remappings are based on neuroplasticity because our nerves are always growing and changing their structure. And when you get a cross-wiring problem, you have to find some ingenious way to basically trick the brain to unwire it with some kind of exercise. And Ramachandran was able to come up with some of those things.
So are you saying that in some pain syndromes, people might consider something like neurofeedback to try to see where the pain might be tracking to and to see what kind of things they might do to change it, since we only have a few minutes to talk about this?
Not neurofeedback. He's invented new, very different approaches to it.
And where would we find those?
Well, I describe those in my book, The Brain That Changes Itself. He was able to... people using his techniques were able to, in some cases, cure this reflex sympathetic dystrophy. Sometimes they used one of the things that happens is when you hurt your ankle, you don't want to move it for a long time, and you start guarding it. And sometimes there can be mistaken wiring things so that, let's say you damaged your ankle very badly. You would not want to move it, and if your friend accidentally almost touched your ankle, you know how you might get a shot of pain, like, don't go there? What happens is that guarding reflex hooks into the pain center to make sure you don't move your limb. And then after a while, even if you're not touched, the guarding reflex can be set off, and because it's connected to the pain system, you can feel pain. It's really quite complicated, and I can't explain it.
No, it may sound complicated, but, you know, the people who have got arthritis know what this is about. You know, the people who have got arthritic pain who start avoiding certain things, you know, the recommendations always are get these tools to help change things and, you know, get
bigger. Well, okay, there's something I can say that I think might be helpful, which is, you know, that there are now some studies that are showing that the more exercise you can the more exercise you can do for these things, the better. When you get any kind of injury, if you go into a period of long-term avoidance of use, those maps will tend to waste away, and in the process of wasting away, they get somewhat disorganized. And when they're in their disorganized state, they can be more prone to having pain. So I mean, this is a very, very tricky area, but the short answer is it's a use-it-or-lose-it brain. If you've got arthritis and you're starting to not use a limb, you've got to think, okay, what is that doing to my brain? And it's going to be leading to some wasting away. By the way, one of the procedures for some people who actually couldn't move their limbs, they were so painful, was actually to imagine moving their limbs as the first stage before they began to move them.
Well, let's move into imagination, because imagination both could be the negative and the positive, is what we've learned from The Brain That Changes Itself by Dr. Norman Doidge, that your imagination, my friends, could be a killer. It could really be hurting you, and it could be helping you. We're going into imagination. Let's talk about that with neuroplasticity, Norm.
Okay. Well, just to give a sense as to how far thoughts go in changing brain structure, let me tell you about one experiment that was done by a physician from Harvard named Pasquale Leone. It was based on something that was first proposed as a thought experiment 100 years ago. And that is this. Pasquale Leone got two groups of people, both of whom had never played the piano before, to listen to a melody, and he showed them the progression. Then he got one group to sit down in front of a computerized piano keyboard and to practice it several hours a day, 5 days a week. And the other group sat in front of the identical keyboard, but instead of actually playing it and moving their fingers, they just imagined moving their fingers. And at the end of the study, what they found when they did a certain kind of a brain scan on both groups is both groups had virtually identical brain scan changes, the ones that actually practiced the piano and those who simply imagined doing so. Quite phenomenal, if you ask me. And not only that, the group that simply imagined playing the piano, if you just gave them 2 hours of physical practice, they were as good as the physical practice group. They immediately caught up. So they were pretty good at the end of this exercise, but they were as good with just a little bit of actual playing. So what this tells us is when we imagine things, we are making changes in our brain structures that are profound. The Canadian, the brilliant Canadian pianist Glenn Gould, at a certain point in his career, actually stopped practicing and did mental practice towards the end of his career.
Sure, and many chess players do that. They no longer have to play the game. They just think the game through.
Yes.
So, and it becomes actually as if you've played each game.
That's right. But the point is that this is leading to changes in brain structure as well. Now, the imagination can be very problematic when you repeat certain ideas, such as obsessional ideas or phobic ideas or certain neurotic ideas. Those get wired into your brain as well. And in the book, I have a chapter on some new techniques that take some elaboration of how to stop those anxieties from getting wired into your brain and blunt their effect. But basically, when a person is worrying over and over again, they're going through a kind of a mental practice that leads them down a very painful dead end. So if it's an obsessional idea or worry, they're getting as much change in their brain as the people who are doing, imaginary mental practice at the piano. So imagination, this is one of the things I've changed my mind about. I used to be a little bit skeptical about people who talked about the use of imagination in sports and these things, and I thought it was really wishful thinking. And that was just my own ignorance of it. And I, too, was caught in this Cartesian dualism. I, believe that, yes, you can change your mind, but that doesn't mean you can change your brain structure, because I didn't know any better. So this book has been just doing the research for this and meeting with the people who have rewired their brains and telling their stories has been very instructive for me. It's nice to be able to change one's opinion about
something. Well, nice to see you're learning.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
you're
and that's
be
what the brain
for
is
a
built
second
to do.
Book.
That's what the brain is built to do. It's, I would say it's a learning machine, but of course I don't believe it's a machine. It's built to learn, and to be healthy, it must be learning. Till the end.
Somebody once described there was no such thing as as neurons that are homeostatic. They said they're either growing or they're dying. And it's like, it's kind of an interesting image to think of our nerves as being like that, our brain as being like that. We're either growing or we're dying, but we're never staying the same.
And in actual fact, you know, if you do a certain kind of measurement of, you know, a basic kind of measurement of what neurons are like in the brain, even when they're in the so-called turned off state, they're not really turned off. What they are is they're firing very infrequently. And when they're in their turned on state, they're just firing faster. So, yes, there's always activity there. And, you know, that old saw that, well, people say you're only using 10% of your brain, that was an attempt to explain the fact that it seems we're capable of incredible growth, but it's a rare phenomenon. And we're always using pretty well all of our brain, but we're not always using it efficiently.
And sometimes we're using it, and, you know, it's not as a judgmental term, sometimes we're using it destructively. When we repeat a frightened thought, an imagined thought, a fear of abandonment, something that we keep saying to ourselves, I'm no good, you know, something wrong with me. That's why I think the talking cure, or the chance to get to speak to somebody who helps you retrain, plus reading this book, The Brain That Changes Itself, by Dr. Norman Doidge, and using whatever other resources you get, is tremendously helpful at trying to keep your brain from just eventually giving up, which mm-hmm. is what I think it can easily do, and that's what it does with some of those folks who get older and they get the Alzheimer's. It's kind of interesting, you know, they turn into children. And, you know, they turn into children who don't have any of the learning that they had. We've got to get going. This is Armand DeMille with me. I wish, Dr. Doidge, I wish we had even more time. If we had more time, I'd want to talk about more romance and stuff. We will do it again one day. It's been fascinating. Name of the book, The Brain That Changes Itself, Norman Doidge. I tell you, it's fabulous stuff. I'll be back with you, my friends, on Tuesday at 1 p.m. with more exciting stuff. On Tuesday, we're having some major physicians in here talking about the drug companies and what their deals really are, but we're going to be talking about it from the inside of psychiatry. I will be back with you then. If you want a copy of today's program, you might call 212-757-4488. Or go to the website, thepositivemind.com, my friends. Bye-bye for now.